Hello there, time travellers and vintage vinyl enthusiasts. Welcome back to the Silver Screen Podcast. I am your host, Michael Wilson, and tonight we're stepping out of the modern world, thank God, and into the neon-lit, dreamlike streets of 1960s London for our deep dive into Edgar Wright's psychological thriller, Last Night in Soho. But unlike Eloise, I'm not making this journey alone. Oh no, tonight is a reunion of sorts. First up, I'm once again joined by my partner in cinematic crime, my very own thunderball to my goldfinger, Mr. DK. How's it going, mate?
I'm all right, except you just labelled me the worst Connery movie, so you git. So, you only live twice. Fuck you.
Okay. I mean, it's the worst Connery, but it's not the worst Bond movie by a long shot.
Oh, God, no.
Just wait until Amazon start cookie-cuttering stuff, but that's a different argument for a different day.
Yeah.
And anyway, and completing our dream team, back by popular demand, or at least because we begged him nicely, it's filmmaker, critic, and fellow founding member of our unofficial Edgar Wright fan club, Michael Whaley. Welcome back, man. You all right?
Hey, how's it going? I'm glad to be back. And I was going to say, that's not the worst Connery film. It's probably the worst Connery Bond film. But there's worse Connery.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm looking at you, yeah. Zardos.
The last time the three of us got together, we geeked out over Scott Pilgrim versus the World, an electrifying comic book adaptation with a distinct Wright energy. But tonight, we're tackling something very different. Last Night in Soho sees Edgar Wright step away from his usual kinetic comedy into a world of psychological horror, giallo influences, and swinging 60s nostalgia. So let's start, as we always do, with first impressions. When you first saw this film, what did you think? Did it transport you or terrorize you, or maybe a bit of both? And DK, I'll come to you first. Why not? No.
I believe this was released during the pandemic, wasn't it?
It was just after we'd kind of had all the lockdowns and stuff. But yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I remember seeing a trailer for it and thinking, oh, that looks interesting. So it took me a while to finally see it. But when I did, I was quite impressed. I didn't kind of hold up on repeat viewings, but it wasn't a bad film when I first watched it.
Okay,
but I was grateful for pretty much anything.
Yeah. Oh, I can see we're going to have a disagreement about part of that. But anyway, let's move over to you, Ellie, and what are your initial thoughts if you can remember back then?
Now it's not my favorite Edgar Wright movie, but that's a hard. that list is difficult to get into the top three or four on that. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I like what Edgar Wright did with this. I will say that I will agree with DK on one part of it. I didn't feel it held up as well the second time, but I think it's one of those that psychological thrillers, once you kind of know the ending, there's very few of them that hold up as well. Like once you know the twist in it or whatever, it's so, but I still thoroughly enjoyed it, but it's not my top four Edgar Wright movies.
That's fair enough. I mean, we'll talk about the twist a bit later on, obviously, and the controversy around the ending of the film, which I didn't know existed. But I'll be honest, it's my second best Edgar Wright film behind Scott Pilgrim. I love it. I think I remember the first time I saw it, like you, DK, I was just happy to be back in the cinemas and seeing something. I wasn't sure it would be my cup of tea because the trailers kind of, they didn't really give you an impression of what you were going to get. And so, you know, I was very skeptical, perhaps, going in and like, okay, we'll see what this is. Had they mentioned, you know, because the trailers really didn't lean into the psychological horror, the, you know, the more giallo-inspired, you know, like the old Italian horror type stuff. And it seemed a bit almost, you know, is this going to be girly drama-esque, for want of a better way to put it? No offense to anyone. But yeah, I went in and absolutely loved it. And the reason that I was so awed by it and still love it now is more the actual craft of filmmaking. I'm not so worried about the story, you know, holding up to scrutiny and, you know, how good is the script or whatever. I'm just in awe of Wright's direction more than anything. And I think it's one of the most stylish and brilliantly directed and you know, created and artistic films I think that I've ever seen, whilst also being something that I enjoy the acting and yes, the writing for the most part or whatever of it as well. So that would be just my two cents on that. But yeah, I just remember really liking it, being very happily surprised coming out of the cinema that it went up to my number two Edgar Wright film, and yeah, being a little bit freaked out because when I first left the cinema, one of my friends FaceTimed me, or whatever the equivalent is on my Android phone. And as they did that, the poster was behind me for Last Night in Soho. So it was just like the really freaky sort of red-tinged Sandy just lumbering behind me as I turned on my phone camera. And I was like, ah, don't do that. So, yeah, it had a bit of a psychological effect on me at the very least. So anyway, right. So with that out of the way, we're going to move on to what we always do, which is to give us a little bit of behind the scenes information. But I don't do that. I hand that over whatever is available to DK to do a little bit of the legwork. So DK, you have some information about Last Night in Soho, I believe.
Yep. It's a 2021 British. So it was pandemic just after. Yeah, as you say, British psychological horror film directed and co-produced by Edgar Wright, co-written by Wright and Christy Wilson Cairns. Stars Thomasin McKenzie as a teenager who moves to London to study fashion design. There she's haunted by visions of Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, a glamorous young woman who had lived during the swinging 60s. It completed principal photography in the summer of 2019 and was originally intended to be released in September 2020. After two further delays due to COVID-19 lockdowns, it finally received its international theatrical release in October 2021. Following its premiere at the 78th Venice International Film Festival on 4th of September 2021, Last Night in Soho was released theatrically in the UK and US on the 29th of October 2021 by Universal Pictures and Focus Features. It received generally positive reviews from critics who praised its technical aspects, direction and performances, while its writing received some criticism, especially the ending. The film grossed $23 million worldwide on a budget of $43 million. It was nominated for two BAFTA Film Awards, including Outstanding British Film and Best Sound. And just a little aside, Stephen King had the opportunity to see this movie in an advanced screening, and he was so impressed by what he saw, he posted, "I hardly ever rewatch. There's so many good things out there, but this one is special." So, yeah, I've got other stuff as we come to... to different categories, but that's what I've got to start off with.
So you two are just going to claim you know better than Stephen King? Sure, whatever.
Stephen King didn't like the Kubrick Shining, so, you know, I also love the guy, but at some points he's seriously wrong.
So we're going to move into the next section then after all of that rambling, which is it's going to be writing and plot. And I'm just going to throw it open because I don't really have anything specific to add. I've just got sections of bits and pieces that I thought were important, which I'll get to. But first of all, DK, do you have anything you wanted to throw us about the writing that you specifically found in your research?
Oh, yeah. I've got shitloads, dude. So, it was inspired by Don't Look Now and Repulsion, 1965's Repulsion. Wright first conceived the idea for Last Night in Soho in 2007. He pitched the plot as a dark Valentine to London and the Soho neighbourhood to producers Neera Park and Rachel Pryor before the start of filming for World's End. Growing up in Somerset, Wright listened to his parents' stories of coming of age in the 1960s, which contributed to his becoming enamoured with the era. He nurtured this obsession through their 1960s record collection, saying he would sort of almost just disappear into that decade through the music. But he recalled that his mother's memories of swinging 60s London were not always fond ones, and that she once said, "I went to Soho once with my friend and we got harassed by a man and chased out, and that's the end of the story." Bit weird. Born in 74, Wright said, "I feel you're always obsessed with the decade you just missed." Sam Mendes first introduced Edgar Wright to screenwriter Christy Wilson Cairns, who later co-wrote 1917 with Mendes. Wilson Cairns told Wright in passing that she'd worked as a bartender at the Toucan in Soho for 5 years and lived around the corner above the Sunset Strip on Dean Street. On the night of the Brexit vote in 2016, they went on a bar crawl through the basement bars of Soho, ending up at one called Trisha's, where Wright pitched her the story of Last Night in Soho. Now, Christy Wilson Cairns, she incorporated a number of her own experiences as a young woman living in London, such as the lecherous taxi driver and the god-awful pickup lines. Wright said, "Something that I find truly nightmarish, and I guess there's an element where I'm sort of giving a sharp rebuke to myself, is the danger of being overly nostalgic about previous decades. In a way, the film is about romanticising the past and why it's wrong to do that." Now, originally, the flashback scenes were going to have no dialogue, only music, to make them feel more like dreams. This was changed when co-writer Wilson Cairn said it was essential that the audience fall in love with Sandy and that it would be much harder to do this if they never heard her speak. Yeah, the character of Eloise is based on Edgar Wright's mother, and Jocasta is the name Edgar Wright would have apparently received if he had been born a girl. Ooh. And yeah, the title comes from the 1968 song by pop band Dave D, Dozy Beaky, Mick and Titch, Last Night in Soho.
Well done. It's
the, yes, it's the song that's played during the end credits. Originally, it was titled Red Light Area, then The Night Has a Thousand Eyes from the 1962 Bobby V hit. Although a conversation Wright had with filmmaker Quentin Tarantino, he was told by Alison Anders that Last Night in Soho was the best title music for a film that's never been made. And if you look at the special thanks in the credits, Quentin Tarantino is listed just after Rachel Sterling.
Cool. Yeah, Rachel Sterling got a special thanks for, obviously, she is the daughter of Dame Diana Rigg, and she obviously gave permission to use, after, you know, her mother had passed away, to use her footage posthumously, and, you know, met with Wright and talked about her mum, so that's why she's there, if anybody was curious. So, yeah, I have a couple of things that I'm hoping you haven't got, actually, because I did say I didn't have, and I have a couple of small anecdotes that I may as well drop in under the writing. The first of which is, as you mentioned, that this was released just after the COVID-19 lockdowns. Apparently, all of the scenes of Soho that play in the end credits that flash up were all filmed during those lockdowns, which is why the streets are completely deserted. Yeah. And I don't know if you have this, but it's a story I have to share because it's just so funny, is that when they were filming at the Toucan bar that you mentioned, they were setting up a shot, and Terrence Stamp apparently was a bit of a grump and said that the stairs weren't fit to be on film. So
they've got a plaque up there.
Yeah, they have a plaque now that says these stairs aren't fit to be on film, quote, and then Terrence Stamp is always on the steps, which I just think is beautifully petty of them, to be honest. So,
yeah, for sure.
Obviously, you did see that, DK.
Yeah.
I love that. So, yeah. I'm sure there's probably more that you can drop into us later as we get into the different sections. But yeah, I'm going to throw it open and I'm going to ask you, really, because obviously you haven't chatted yet, what stands out to you about the writing and the plot that you wanted to bring up and, you know, mention to us?
Well, after hearing, I didn't know that about that they wanted it originally to be just with music. And I definitely agree with the co-writer that she was right that, yeah, you definitely need to, for the ending, you need to really love Sandy. And, you know, I mean, just as a filmmaker, you've got to. So for the writing on that, I agree that them changing it to have her have dialogue and do that, I think, was great. Overall, I mean, I think it's very well written. I think that they do a good job subverting, you know, expectations, which is always good in a psychological thriller. And I don't really have anything. I don't have anything really negative other than, you know, thinking on it more. I know what I didn't realize the controversy, but the one part of the movie that I didn't like as much was the ending, you know, that post thing. Like, I think it could have ended before then and been fine. And I don't think it added anything to the movie. So. Okay.
That's fine. That seems like a good place to jump into then, because it was one of the kind of subsections that I had. And before we do that, I will say, heavy spoiler alert, there is a big kind of reveal and, you know, there's a mystery at the heart of this movie. And if you haven't seen it, please don't listen to this first. Go watch the movie, then come back here, because we are going to be discussing the ending and it kind of ruins the movie because you're not supposed to know in advance. And I think we probably all admit that it had more of an impact the first time we saw it, not knowing what was coming, than if we'd heard and we're kind of like, oh, that doesn't really work or whatever. But yeah, so what, you know, with bearing in mind we've now given a spoiler warning, what in specific, you know, did you not have an issue with as part of the ending, Mike?
I didn't think it added anything to it having... seeing Sandy in the mirror at the end.
Mm. Yeah, like, that's the briefest part at the very end that I am always baffled by. I don't
understand the point, because here's the thing. If she was haunted by everything Sandy had done, you know, kind of on, I mean, Sandy twisted, obviously, but if that character had gotten broken and gotten revenge, but like if Eloise was haunted by everything and that's where she was seeing, and it wasn't just her dreams because she was seeing it near the end, in while she's awake and trying to escape, like, what does Sandy, and I assumed it had to do with the location and everything they were trying to get, the ghosts were trying to get her to release them. Mm-hmm. But I guess, is it saying that Sandy, because she did that, she isn't released, and then she's stuck there, and now she's going to haunt Eloise. Like, I mean, Eloise helped her at the end. So, yeah. Like, I don't understand what it brings to the story to even do that.
Yeah,
wouldn't it be cool if Sandy was here at the end?
That's literally what I was going to say. Yeah, I think it is literally style over substance, because I think we try to assign some meaning to it, which clearly isn't intended. And I think
as a filmmaker, I know that happens a lot. But, like, yeah. I mean, my thing from a writing perspective, though, I was trying to figure out, like, what that, like, not necessarily what it means, but what's it bringing to the story. And I don't think it brings anything else to the story.
It just felt like, to me, like one of those coders on, say, like Nightmare on Elm Street, where everything works out, and then, you know, we'll throw in a little curveball at the end just because
to keep it going. But like, if they were going to make more of this was Last Night in Soho 1, and then Last Night in Soho 2, The Revenge, and then Last Night in Soho 3, Dream Warriors. And here's the thing, it fits with this whole thing. She was dreaming when she was doing all that, so it does go there.
Not just that, there's actual physical manifestations of her visions. She has a hickey. So it's clearly affecting her on an actual physical level, which we never get into.
We don't know what old Sandy was doing while she was sleeping. We don't know. I just don't, like you said, it doesn't necessarily, I don't see how it's, honestly, if anything, it's just a little confusing, which you don't want that for your audience unless you're, I don't know. I just don't see a gain from it, I guess. And, I mean, maybe someone smarter than me can be like, well, this is what they meant or something like that. And it does that. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll give it that. But for right now, I still haven't seen anything that's like, I guess, makes sense for it to be.
I don't think there is anything. I mean, I looked because I had the same issue with you, which is that it's okay to find some things confusing. And I, you know, sometimes I acknowledge that and I'm like, okay, I didn't get it, whatever. But it's not great when it is literally the last impression you leave of your movie on someone. When you're walking out going, I loved it, but what?
You know what would have actually made more sense to me? If it would have been Terrence Stamp's character.
The guy who she inadvertently got killed.
She inadvertently got killed. I mean, it's his fault for standing in the road, but still, like, he was trying to run and arguing with her about stuff she was accusing him of that wasn't true. Inadvertently got him killed. If anybody's going to come back to haunt her, it's going to be Terrence Stamp's character.
To be fair, though, he did sound like a creepy guy. I mean, the bartender was like, what is it, Mr. Hans, because he just creeps.
And I think they probably put that in to try to make it seem. Well, honestly, they put that in because he wanted people to think that it was Matt Smith's character.
Of course.
But. Yeah, I don't know. I just, like, it would have made more sense than having Sandy there, because Sandy's story was finished when she stayed in the fire.
I try not to overthink it. I literally just, to me, it reeks of, like, they were having a late night session or whatever, breaking the film, and then somebody turned around and was like, oh, Edgar, wouldn't it be so cool if Sandy appeared in the mirror at the end? And he was like, oh, yeah, it would be. But then nobody was like, but why?
Yeah.
What's the logic behind it? And it was just like, oh, no, it looks cool. Like, okay. Whatever, I don't overthink it, but I think maybe I'm wrong, but in the little bit of research that I did, I don't think that's the only thing people have issue with in terms of the ending and the writing and the script. What I found was a lot of people,
I think this is the problem I have a little with it.
Okay, well, I'll ask you then first before I come into it. What was your biggest issue with the ending?
You go through all this, you watch Sandy go through all this horrendous stuff, and, you know, there's supposed to be this empowering moment, but it to make Sandy the actual heel at the end of the film kind of undoes a great deal of what's gone on for me. I can see why they did it, but it undermines a lot of what's going on. And you're kind of then presented with a scene where you're supposed to sympathize with all these dudes that she's killed.
Oh, I strongly disagree. I think
you're deliberately, say that. You can disagree.
You're deliberately invited to empathize with Sandy, and I have an issue with that.
No, but Sandy could have turned around, made this confession, and maybe gone about it another way. There would have been no need to try and off Eloise. It's just, to me, it's kind of running out of an idea and just making this character that you've empathized with and fallen in love with over the case of the film, and just said, look, she's pulled herself out of her circumstances. She didn't end up dead like you originally thought. She's the one that's been there all the time. Now let's make her the villain. And well, that pulls the rug out to me.
See, what I thought from it, and maybe this is Michael does as well, like thinks as well, but like somebody can be turned into a villain in real life and then continually making bad choices. Like, yes, she was the victim, but because of the things that happened to her, she unfortunately made a conscious choice and then became, and then kept doing it. And then like, to me, she becomes a bad guy. Like when that happens, not that she's killing these gross guys that, you know, are offered, like, here's the thing. Like, the guys that she's murdering aren't necessarily bad people. Well, and that's where it comes in. Like, that's why you can sympathize with some of them, because it could just be, hey, you know, because you're helping us get this bar going like that, I've got a girl that will sleep with you. They don't know her story.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't like, so, and so when she starts killing them and they're disappearing and stuff like that, like, she's taking her frustrations out from, I can't remember Matt Smith's character's name, on these Jack, other people. So like, Jack, that doesn't make her still a good person. And like, if you did that in regular real life, you're still a murderer. Yeah. Like, and the fact that she goes even so far later to like, so I never thought that she was, they were trying to be redeemed by her admitting what she had done. Like, I think she was still a bad person, you know, like I, at the end of the day, she got turned into a bad person, but like people who were beat as a child who are now beating their kids when they grow up, you're beating your kids, you're a bad person. Like, it's the same basic premise. Just because they had something that turned them that way doesn't mean, now granted, people can be fixed, and I don't say fixed, but you know, like they can help with therapy and stuff like that, but there's a choice that gets made there, and she made it and went the other way. Like it was just like, you can either try to fix yourself or start murdering and have fun with it. And that's what she did. And I think that's what goes to show, like, when she thought she might get caught as a very old woman, she still was going to murder an innocent person who just happened to find out about it.
Yeah. I have so many thoughts about that.
I at no point thought she was, the only time I thought she was a good person was when in the flashbacks before she got turned into a murderer. Like, it was just, so I see, that's why I didn't necessarily have a problem with that, because she was a bad guy. Now, Eloise forgiving her, yes, that worked. Like, I didn't have a problem with that. She was going to kill herself anyways, but in that house. But, you know, I don't know. That's why I didn't have a problem with that part of it. It's just, I didn't think they were trying to, like, I thought the subversion of the entire writing was that you think she's this great innocent person who gets killed, and she wasn't. She was an innocent person that got corrupted and then became a bad person.
See, I took it as, yeah, she was an innocent person as such. She got corrupted, and, you know, you think she's going to be the victim in all. And she comes out of it on the other side. She's not a victim. She's actually the landlady, which is fine. And you feel great because, you know, her life wasn't cut short. However, when she turns around and then, you know, as I say, tries to off Eloise, it kind of undermines, for me anyway, any development that the character had.
Weirdly, I'm coming at this from a third position, and I kind of wish we had a female or female identifying person on this episode, because in the course of my research, I found that what I already thought the film was doing was potentially the intent, in that Sandy is not portrayed as villainous. It's portrayed that she's going through this emotional and horrific trauma that women did and do go through. And, you know, I don't want to say the murder is justified, but it's certainly understandable. And that's why I don't love that the film never, to me, takes the stance of fully villainizing her, for want of a better word, or it kind of always seems to be quite sympathetic to her plight. And I understand that, particularly if you regard it as, I think Christy Wilson Cares has said, like I said, it's because it's about, you know, emotional female trauma and the crap that they go through. And it does go to pains to show you it's not just a question of, you know, she was sleeping with men. It was, they were abusive. They were hitting her. They were harming her, you know, even her pimp. The Matt Smith character was being very abusive towards her, and she couldn't find a way out of this situation. And I don't love, like I said, that it's kind of because as you said, part of me wants to think, because of my own situations in life, and I guess privilege, well, she still murdered a bunch of people, so she's still evil. And I don't know if, like I said, a woman that's watching this would necessarily look at that the same way and wouldn't just think, yeah, she's bad, but I get it, if you know what I mean.
I do. What I was thinking, but like, here's the thing, though. Not everyone that she was with was abusive to her, though. Like,
we don't really see anything. Well, here's the thing.
I thought there was one that didn't seem that way. I mean, he was creepy because he was an old white guy who shouldn't have been trying to sleep with a 20-year-old girl. Like, or 20, I don't know her age at the time, but like not everybody was doing that. It's like when they started doing the reveal, like, it made it seem like she was just doing it to everyone that had to come sleep with her, or that came to sleep with her. And that's where I'm like, okay, she ended up making a conscious choice at some point because of all the trauma to go, you know what? I'm just going to kill them all. And that's why there were so many ghosts and stuff like that. So like, yeah. And that's where, to me, it villainized her, is that she was a good person who was then corrupted and only could take so much, and then started doing it, but then kept doing it.
The film is basically positing, well, they were bad enough because they were wanting to, you know, go to a prostitute for sex, and she was clearly young and unwilling, and that's bad enough. Do you know what I mean? These weren't just,
I can justify the killing of the Johns. It's when she turns around and decides, you know, I'm going to kill Eloise. That's when you just think, you're kind of undoing everything that's come before it.
I think he was kind of trying to set up from the start that, you know, obviously back then, these kind of girls were treated as commodities. You see that little section behind the scenes after the little Sandy Shaw sequence. And I think at that point, it's setting up the fact that just by their actions, these guys are fair game.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's, to me, and again, this may be me reading into it or seeing more than was presented, but to me, it was, she always looked unwilling. And whether you've kind of paid or not, and whether you claim you don't, you know, I don't know what's going on or whatever else, if you're having sex with someone who's visibly unwilling to do it.
Oh, yes. 100%, 100%. But like, there's a lot of people now who wouldn't notice or pick up on somebody who looks unwilling. You know, but
no,
100%. I can 100% look at somebody and go, oh, you're not happy with what you're doing here. We're not going to do this, but I'm a good person. But that does, you know, I'm just saying, just because someone doesn't notice social cues doesn't make them a bad person.
Yeah, I mean, there's more to it, because it obviously makes the guys appear very sleazy and everything as well. I mean,
like I said,
not just them. I mean, even the cab driver and stuff, the implication is, you know, and again,
the time period was. Yeah. Most of them weren't bad people, but I'm just saying, like, my ultimate thing is just like, for them, to me, making her the villain, why I didn't have a problem with it was because they set it up with what they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, 100% started that way and did that, but it made it seem like, especially with her, I guess I'm basing it not at the time of seeing it. I was 100% pro Sandy until we find out that Sandy's the landlord and then tries to kill Eloise, who I'm 100% for is a good person. Once she tried to do that, I'm like, oh, she doesn't have a problem killing anymore. And how much back, and then when they show the flashbacks, how much of that was what she was reading into it, and how much of the fact was what, like, somebody deserves getting killed for putting their hands on her and stuff like that. And some of just who just wanted sex. So, like, I guess my assumption on all the stuff that could have happened was because they did turn her full villain when she went after Eloise and then stabbed an innocent guy. And that could have been racism, but
well, I mean, she does tell Eloise to rescue the boy, in fairness. So
at the end, but that's when she's had her turn back to like, oh yeah, I guess I deserve this, is what her take at the end there is, when she's like, go rescue him, y'all get out of the house, y'all didn't do anything wrong. you know,
I mean, as much as I'm saying, you know, I'm not giving this as my view, because I don't like I said, that to me, the film never turns Sandy full villain, and should, because I don't like what she does. But like I said, I'm certainly not going to argue that fact with a woman who's like, if it's justifiable because of trauma or whatever else. I mean, you're identifying with Eloise, I would say, as the main character. And Eloise clearly falls in love with Sandy. And at the end of the movie, even when she finds out she's murdered all these people, her response is basically, oh, well, I forgive you. And it's kind of like, I don't love that. You know, it's kind of... she never really seems to acknowledge that Sandy's done anything bad, because she just loves the nostalgia of it, I guess, or something. And I guess that feeds into what Wright was saying about, like, beware of, you know, looking through rose tinted glasses. The past isn't always great, and you have to acknowledge. But then the problem I have is that Ellie never does acknowledge that. It's quite the opposite. She actually does the whole fashion show based on 60s fashion and sees 1960s version of Sandy in the mirror at the end and everything. And it's like, well, where's that message then? Because the message otherwise seems to be, you know, nostalgia is great, well, but, you know.
Now that you say that like that, though, that actually gives me a different interpretation of the ending in the mirror.
Yeah.
Because maybe that's what it is, because she still looked back on that time with rose-colored glasses. And and now, and just like, because she's still doing that, and Edgar Wright's statement that not everything should be looked on in awe, like, maybe that's Sandy coming back going, you didn't learn anything from this.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and I do
got a hold on it. Yeah.
And I do wonder if there's a reason why they kind of George Lucas it and have it be 1960s Sandy and not Sandy as she looked when she died.
Yeah.
Because she didn't look like that.
Yeah, so, for sure.
So, yeah. Anyway, what was I going to say? Yeah, to the other point as well, though, to your point, DK, apparently there are subtle hints in the script that it's not just a question of Sandy having kind of turned her life around, stopped killing, and pulled her way out of this. The implication is supposedly that the reason that she asks for 2 months' rent in advance is that she says that a lot of women tend to flee in the night. And I think the implication there is either others have found the floorboards full of corpses, or other girls have had visions and she's, you know, she's off them, basically. So it's possible she could have just been never stopped killing since the 60s, in which case, like I said, you really need to villainize her a bit more, perhaps, than they do. And, you know, credit to Diana Rigg for giving a good performance. I mean, she doesn't, you don't hate her at all until, like you said, she goes full maniac at the end. And I think that's more a trope of the genre of film. But I just like that the twist existed, because I think it would have been really boring if it wasn't there. It would have been a really dull film. And I can see a lot of the criticism that I saw was people that just go, the film was really, really good until they revealed that Sandy wasn't actually killed by Matt Smith's character. It was the other way around. And I was like, but if that was the ending of the movie, where's the twist? Where's the kind of, you just end and that's that. I don't get what, that's not satisfying to me at all.
You see, I would much rather had that whole conversation where she sat down with a cup of tea and just Diana Rigg confessing, and then Ellie saying, yeah, I'm going to go now. You know, I would have much rather that than have her try you off Ellie.
I see what you mean, but I think, like I said, it's subservient to the genre it's trying to make. And by that point, it's crossed fully over into, like I said, giallo and psychological thriller, and the ghosts have fully haunted her and everything. So it seems like that's where the film has to go, is that kind of final, you know, monster chase, I guess, for want of a better way. And,
but I think that's kind of a problem with...
Okay.
I mean, I'm not familiar with giallo. I've seen the odd movie, but... that's as far as it goes. So I can't say how, you know, how adamant to that kind of genre this is, other than a superficial level. But on that superficial level, I find that, you know, you throw in, occasionally they'll throw a character in there and that'll be the character's only appearance. And it's just to serve a plot purpose later on. You don't see any comeback from some of these characters. And some of it looks great, don't get me wrong. I think it looks beautiful, this thing. But when you scratch that kind of surface underneath, a lot of it's kind of very hollow. I don't think there's as much plotting put into this as there could have been. And I think that's the problem I'm having.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I certainly wouldn't counter that as such, because I don't really have a counter other than it doesn't bother me as much. But I certainly can't say you're wrong, because, I absolutely see where you're coming from with that. It's
just an opinion on that point.
Yeah, but I mean, you are right. I mean, from a writing circumstance, it is flimsier at the end. It's just, like I said, I was fine with what it did. You may not be, and a lot of people weren't. Like I said, but the awful majority just seemed to think the film should have ended with, you know, Eloise solving the crime, Sandy got killed, Matt Smith did it, he was actually Terrence Stamp's character and we got him arrested. And I was like, that would be so freaking boring.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Here's the thing, there's no twist at that point. Like, they aren't subverting us at all. The whole point for Terrence Stamp and all them is to make it seem like that's what's going to happen. So, like if that's what actually happened, then, you know, what would be the whole thing with a there would be no twist. It would just be a news report at that point.
I do think I think a bit of it is people not being all that film literate because they don't like, well, we could never have worked that out, and we thought we'd worked it out from the clues you gave us. And it's like, yeah, that's how mysteries and thrillers work.
I do think it would have been better had young Jack been in more than a very short couple of minutes scene.
I don't think he was in
Lindsay.
The Terrence Stamp's younger version.
I see what you mean. Young Lindsay, the vice cop. Yeah.
Lindsay, yeah.
I do agree there too, because it's almost like we completely forgot about him at that point. I wonder if there is deleted scene where like he was talking to her more at a different time.
I agree,
because it also would have been if she was just like, no, there's nothing wrong. And she doesn't help him because she is murdering these people and is going to go to jail. I think that would have gone more to develop Sandy, but where would you have put that is all my only thought is. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess you still could have put that in there. If she was just like, oh no, I'm fine like that, then it would have just been like a classic abusive relationship, you know, with Matt Smith, like that she's like that. And he's like, let me help you get out. Let me help you get out. Like, I think that could have gone in, and I think that would have gone like, DK thing like would have gone a long way to do that and would have helped. So I definitely agree there.
Sure. Yeah, I can't disagree. Anything else you wanted to say, DK?
No, that's pretty much it.
Cool. I have little tiny bits on my notes about the writing that I wanted to mention. One of the things I also like that the film does that I have to bring up is the way that it makes it kind of foreshadows a lot of things in dialogue and other situations, or references things that have happened or that are going to happen. So, you know, from the very start of the movie, you get Ellie's grandma, is it, forewarning her about London, and you know, it was too much for your mum and she got completely overwhelmed. And I think that's, you know, it's obvious, but it's interesting that that's there, because then obviously you get the cab driver. And but there's a couple of really smart moments. That was when they're going to the Halloween party, and the character John says, we'll just have to slap a bit of this on, and if anybody asks, tell them I'm a ghost. John's like, oh, interesting. And the other one being when, just before you've had the reveal about Diana Rigg, when she says, I would have killed your gentleman friend last night if I'd have caught him. Turns out she wasn't being hyperbolic. she very probably meant that, you know. So, let's see, where have I got this? Yeah, I like that. That was the other thing I have a kind of a weird relationship with this movie in terms of confusion, is that I tend to always veer on the side that things are such a way for a reason when I'm analyzing films. And I find it really bizarre that the one quote unquote good guy is called John when this is dealing with like men that go to prostitutes. And I'm like, what is that trying to say? It's I don't think it is necessarily anything. Maybe it is just a coincidence, but I'm analyzing it like, is that saying that, even though like one of the things I don't love is that I don't think it needs the traditional romance story for Ellie. I think that's tacked on and it just feels a bit flimsy. But is it trying to say that he's bad secretly as well, or is it just for the pun of like, well, she tried to kill another John at the very end kind of thing? Or
I don't know. That might be what it also could just be. 100% like the mirror thing, just going, would it be funny if this character's name was John?
No, did you guys have any thoughts about that or the character of John in particular in terms of how he was written? Because
I like John.
I mean, I like him. You're invited to like him, but he doesn't have a narrative function for me.
I think, having someone at the school that there and someone to help her to an extent, I think, is needed. Honestly, he was one of my favorite characters. He's one of my favorite people in the movie, and I was either going to be Terrence Stamp or what is his name? Michael.
I don't know. I did look it up briefly.
I don't know how to pronounce that last
Michael
name.
Michael Ajao. 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 I genuinely don't know how to pronounce it either. Sorry.
I wonder if they have it written here phonetically.
But No, I mean, I get you, but I don't think he had to be a love interest. That's where I had to kind of issue with it.
Here's the thing. I guess I don't know that he... I guess he is a love interest. I would say that it seems more like they're friends, and then she, when going through something traumatic, decides, hey, let's go back to the house to fool around, and then that's when it, you know, sort of thing. Like, I guess to me it didn't seem like, oh, we're trying to date. It just seemed like they were friendly, and then they were teenagers, early 20s, whatever age for college, and you know, people tend to hook up a lot.
I guess, to me, it came across that he really liked her right from the start. Oh, no. I don't think
100% that he really liked her, but like I said, I didn't really think of it as, I mean, him liking her doesn't make him a love interest, but
true. Yeah,
you know, but and that just is his character arc. But I think that, like, I mean, I do think, but I think it was trauma of what she was dealing with that made her go, because it was almost out of nowhere and he was surprised, like, hey, why don't you come back to my place? It doesn't matter that I'm not allowed to have men after a certain time, sort of thing. It was just because it was almost surprising to him there too, which I think it was like she didn't want to be alone doing that. And like, hey, this is how I'll get him back to my place, which she probably didn't need to do. But also they needed it story-wise for her to have flashbacks to Sandy getting killed at the same time, which, you know, I think it was needed for story, because if he was only just a friend and he didn't like her or anything like that, it would have been weird. Bringing him back to the place wouldn't have made sense.
Yeah. So I will say there's a deleted scene that I wish they'd kept in, which kind of, for me, adds a little bit to that, which is that just before they start, you know, going at it, they both reveal that they're virgins to each other. And I was like, I don't know why you would cut that. That to me is kind of crucial information, you know. It's nice that they open up to each other on that level, because it shows that, you know, the connection that obviously Sandy wouldn't have had with any of these men. So that I kind of was not loving. But no, I don't know, part of me worries that it's just a kind of, again, not to be controversial or offend anyone, but it is his presence entirely just so you can go, not all men, you know what I mean? Because like every other
I didn't get that from that, but
I'm like, every other man in the film is sleazy down to the... Although saying that, not really, because you do have the kind bartender guy, I suppose, who I momentarily...
Yeah, and then the other cop and stuff. There's some in there, they're not big characters.
The cop, to be fair, the male cop is a dick. It's the female cop who comes to her defense, and he's like in the bathroom going, oh, yeah, just narrow it down to everybody. So I think...
Oh, no, I meant the... Not the one in Current Times, I meant the 60s.
Return
Stamp.
Lindsay.
Lindsay, yeah.
I meant Lindsay.
But then we do learn he's not a very nice guy in the present. So again, it's kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's just me perhaps reading too much into it and being hypercritical of a film that I said I love. But and I will say, this is completely apropos of nothing, but I do like that John gets the best jokes in the film. They're not my favorite lines in the film or anything, but I do love the way he says, it can be completely overwhelming coming to London from where you've been. And she asks where he comes from, and he goes, South London.
South London.
As if it's like another world. It's like, oh, yeah, I didn't know you drove and have a car. Yeah, how else would I get here from South London? Come on, man. Anyway, so that's all my thoughts on the writing, because we've talked about that at length. And... truly, you know, debated back and forth and really analyzed that. So do you guys have any last thoughts on the writing, or shall I move to acting?
I've said everything.
Yeah, I think I've said everything.
Yeah, it was an interesting discussion. Hopefully the audience find it so as well, because it's interesting that we all came at it from three different angles, and we all have valid points. I have a mountain to get to on directing, but we'll start with acting first, because that's what I have next on my list here. So, DK, do you have anything to share with us about the acting?
Yep, right. He initially cast Anya Taylor-Joy as Eloise before realizing that she'd already played several other similar roles, so he then cast her as Sandy. Terrence Stamp, where he gets hit by a car, that's actually him doing that first part of the car. It's him turning and being struck by the car's bonnet, going over the windscreen.
That's hood to our American listeners, by the way.
Oh, yes, sorry. But the bonnet... The hood is a prop made of foam. The cut to a point of view from inside the cab is—it's obviously an actual stuntman. It's also not Stamp lying on the ground all bloodied, because I just couldn't bring myself to make 82-year-old Terrence Stamp lie in the street in the middle of Soho, a garage state. According to Wright, after George Miller saw an early cut of the film, he was so impressed by Taylor-Joy's performance that he met her immediately and offered her the part in Furiosa.
Underrated film, by the way. Go see that if you haven't.
Okay. Beth Singh plays Cilla Black in this film, but she also performs as Cilla Black as a tribute band, with videos available of performances across various platforms. Yeah. It was the, obviously you mentioned it earlier, it's the final performance of Dinah Rigg, who passed away on September the 10th, 2020. The film is dedicated to her memory, and her only child, actress Rachel Sterling, receives a special thanks in the end credits. It's also the final performance of British actress Margaret Nolan, who plays the barmaid in, I believe it's the bit where Sandy's kind of going wild in that little montage.
Well, I'm going to start by talking about Thomasin McKenzie, because I have to say a bit of information really shocked me about her. She's from New Zealand. Yep. Did you guys know this?
Is she?
Yep. That Cornish accent that is completely Cornish
accent.
That was a fantastic Cornish accent. That was flawless. Yeah, if you hear her speaking, obviously Kiwi accent, New Zealand actress, would never have known that in a million years, which I think just adds to the performance, because... yeah, this is so good, honestly. I can only assume she had either an accent coach or Edgar Wright coached her. People that are best at accents, they tend to give it away if they've only got like a sentence of a word or two. And the thing that I always, when I heard that, the thing I went back to was when she's, looking really crestfallen, and John comes up to her at the party and says, "Oh, this is your can of Coke, isn't it?" And she just goes, "Have it," or something like that. And I'm like,
yeah.
Two word sentence, and yet the accent doesn't lapse at all.
Yeah. That is brilliant. Seriously, I honestly thought she was from Cornwall.
Yeah, me too. When I first saw this, absolutely. Yeah.
And I just thought, man, maybe she's just, just really good with accents, but she's from elsewhere in Britain. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah, no, New Zealand. So, yeah, no, I haven't got much else to say, except I really love her performance in this, and I really wish she would make something else that I want to watch, because she's done a few things since then, but it's not anything that I'm interested in. But I really want to see her in more, and I hope she does get cast in more. I think it's a performance where she has to carry the film, and you, as much as they were kind of saying you need to fall in love with Sandy, I'm way more falling in love with Ellie, to be perfectly honest, during the movie. I don't know, like I said, the kind of sympathising with the murderer part at the end, which is my only real kind of issue, but that's a character thing, not really an acting thing. It's a writing issue. So other than that, that's really all I have to say about Thomasin. Any thoughts from you guys on her?
No, I do. I get where you're coming from, and I'm wondering if you fall in love with Eloise as a character rather than Sandy, is because, strangely enough, Sandy, you don't see Sandy as someone that's needing protection, whereas Eloise, you kind of do.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
Which is really weird, because Eloise, other than the kind of visions and stuff like that, isn't really in any danger at the start of the movie, whereas Sandy's just right up.
She's going through a crap time, though, as you said. You do really feel, I think it's because it's such an emotional performance that you feel for her when she's being kind of ostracized by the other girls, and she's so alone at the party, and she does the kind of, for me, the kind of Baby Driver callback of getting lost in the headphones and the music and just crawling into a corner somewhere.
Well, so, also, something I would say with that, too, is you also know that she's lost her mother. There's a much more backstory with Eloise than there is with Sandy.
Yeah.
And so, like, you see Sandy as just somebody who's, already there going and trying to get, wants to be famous for a famous singer. And just, like, that's all you know for her. You don't know that, like, when we meet Eloise, we, like, there, sees the ghost of her mom is a thing. And, living with grandma, but got her dream thing of going to school, design school and stuff like that. Like, you already have so much stuff there to like Eloise. Sandy is just, we don't even know what she is at first. And we have nothing knowing other than I want to be famous.
Yeah. And I think,
it's easy to want to, and Eloise was one of my favorites in the movie as well, but I mean, there's much more there. And I mean, that goes into the writing a little bit and character development. But yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me.
Absolutely. But I think you have to like Eloise, because everything you know about Sandy and every kind of contact you have with her is through Eloise's eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether you know it or not. So if you don't kind of believe the source, as it were, it's not going to have that same impact. And I think also this is, again, perhaps a slight detour, but I think it's because I am somebody who's from a very kind of small town in England, and if I was to go to London, I would exactly be completely overwhelmed, just like she is.
I'll tell you a little story here. The first time I went to London, I was kind of, it was a holiday with my family, and we stayed in a hotel, and I did not leave the hotel for 2 days. I got a constant headache because I was just completely freaking overwhelmed by it.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. But worth remembering, I'm also autistic. So, you know, an awful lot of neon flashing lights and, you know, traffic noise and too many people would probably cause me to go feral.
It's all neurodivergence.
It's weird. It's really weird because later on I took to it like a duck to water. And as I told you, Mike, before we started recording, I spent quite a substantial amount of time in both Soho and Fitzrovia, where a lot of this was filmed, and felt really at home there. So it's weird how it kind of, you do get acclimatized to it.
Fair enough. Maybe I would, but we'll probably never know. But anyway, yeah, so moving on from Thomasin, did you guys have anything else you wanted to say about her before I move on?
No, just the tone at the start of the movie, I don't know if it's partly her acting or partly the direction, but it kind of threw me because she's very silly in those first few.
I love that. Opening it really sequence. Says it's just getting to know her because it's showing that she's obsessed with fashion and
I think I wasn't prepared for how dark it was going to get just from that scene alone.
Yeah, because she has to charm you early. And again, I think that's a good, as you said, it's writing, it's direction, it's the performance. And if you don't immediately fall in love with this character, you're just left when she's overwhelmed by London thinking, well, why should I care? Do you know what I mean? So I think it's to set that up and to kind of show you, and to show you why she's there. Because part of you would also just be like, well, if you're getting so freaked out and there's so much bad crap going, just go home. But it's like, well, no, this is her dream and she's, you know, got her dream job and she wants to try and stick it out. So she does for a while, you know. Cool. Well, moving on to Anya Taylor-Joy, I have to say I was shocked to hear, because I didn't know that you say that she was originally cast in the other role, because I think she's so perfect for Sandy. And everything that I've seen her do is more that area than the Eloise character. I can't imagine her playing vulnerable for some reason, because I've only really seen her play badasses and, you know, either evil, violent people or badasses.
I think until this point, the only thing I kind of seen her in was The Witch. She kind of is like an innocent. So I can kind of see, but I don't know this numerous roles that she's had where she plays this naive, innocent character.
No, and I mean, I'm thinking of things like Furiosa, the X-Men film she was in, or The Menu. These are all things where she's not at all meek and vulnerable and retiring as a character.
The Queen's Gambit, which is, you know, the series, I mean, she's vulnerable, but also strong when she knows what she's doing, like, at a certain time. And then, yeah, there's some other stuff from early on, though, that I think she 100% was playing like that, from the 17s to, you know...
I get you, yeah.
2019. There was a lot of stuff up through there, because she did a lot of stuff after The Witch.
Got you. Yeah.
And
I do think the Sandy role kind of suits, I would say, her particular acting vibe better, and I can see why they would have done that. Because again, you kind of have to fall in love with Sandy, and you have to see why Ellie is so obsessed with her, and I think you do. But it's also a really great acting performance because you also watch her get more and more strung out and hopeless, and to a point where it's believable that she murdered, you know, Matt Smith's character. Otherwise, it would just be silly if she just turned on a dime from happy-go-lucky to that. And I do think it kind of, for me, I followed that journey and was kind of like, yeah, I can see how you got to this point, you know. So do you guys have any thoughts on Anya before I move on?
I think she's great in everything she does.
She's just flawless. I've never seen her give a bad performance. I don't mean in, you know, the looks kind of thing. I mean, obviously.
No, but she's not a bad-looking woman either.
She's attractive, yes. But, I've not seen her give one bad performance in anything that she's done. I mean, you mentioned New Mutants, and she was, like, pretty much the highlight of that movie.
Yeah. I was just looking through her resume here. And one of the ones I was going to mention that she's in that I just watched, it's fantastic, which I had seen the trailer and really liked it, but I'll wait for that one. But I forgot that she was with Olivia Cooke and Anton Yelchin in Thoroughbreds from 2017.
I haven't seen that either.
And no. That is one that was, the character was a little more like Eloise. But no, the new the sci-fi-ish horror, The Gorge, that just came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's great.
I love it. Okay. Yeah. I've heard good things. Yeah.
It's definitely worth seeing. It's on Apple TV. I love the fact that it's a movie that looks like it's going to be an action movie that isn't an action movie. It's definitely a science fiction horror movie. So
Fair enough. Awesome.
But you know, she's great.
So I'm just going to, we'll deal with everyone else in kind of one swoop because time's not on our side. So I have to, and I only have a little bit to say about everyone. I think Matt Smith, I think, does a really good job selling you on his charm, and you can believe that that Sandy is charmed by him. But then he's also equally convincing as the absolute sinister creep, you know, that that he turns out to be, which again is impressive as somebody who, you know, at the time I was watching this film was just like, it's the Doctor.
Yeah,
I remember Lost River. He plays a villainous character in that as well. He's, okay. He's like this skinhead, bother boot wearing yob. So
playing not a great guy too, so
yeah, but that hadn't happened yet. If I'd seen House of the Dragon, I'd fully believe the performance more. But like I said, at this point in time, he hadn't not been the Doctor for very long, and I was kind of like, I mean, he had, but you know, we're nerds. It's always like when you first see somebody after leaving that role, that's always what you're going to do.
Oh no, for sure.
Yeah, but no, I thought it was great. And Terrence Stamp, likewise, I think he really sold the sinister, creepy guy. I wish we'd got, like you guys, a little bit more of him in the past, or of him not being creepy, to show that reveal a little bit more, you know, that makes sense, because it kind of, I get that it's supposed to be a surprise, but it very much does come out of nowhere, and we don't get any hints that he's a nice guy, really, which would have been nice, even if it was a little moment of, I don't know, I'm spitballing, but like helping somebody up who fell down on the street or something at some point, you know, or any number of things that showed, you know, he's not just this really creepy force that's always creeping in on her, because that feels like cheating. I have to obviously mention Dame Diana Rigg. I think her dedication to the role is brilliant. The way she seems prickly, then you really warm to her. And then, like I said, she just becomes this kind of pleasant old lady type. And again, this is a character actress who I do know, DK Diana Rigg. So I had no indication that she was going to be revealed as the kind of big bad of the movie. And throughout her scenes, I'm just like, oh, bless Diana Rigg, RIP. She was great in The Avengers and Game of Thrones and any number of other things. That one Doctor Who episode with Matt Smith. But yeah, just a good performance by a great actress. And I was just watching with sadness, because at this point we knew we'd lost her, but kind of in awe of the level, the caliber of actor that was in the movie and the performance that was given. It was nice to see Mrs. Doyle from Father Ted in this. That's going to particularly only resonate with a very small section of the audience. Yeah,
you don't get much to do, but she gets a really. You don't want a Vesper. You want a cup of tea. Go on.
Ah, go on now. But no, I really thought she was excellent in the one speech that she gets with Ellie at the bar, which is like, you know, people come here to chase their hopes and dreams or whatever else. I can't remember it now, but I think she was really good in that scene. And it's a nothing role, but it was still nice to see her. Pauline McLean, I should say, not actually Mrs. Doyle, although she'll always be Mrs. Doyle to us Father Ted fans. So, and yeah, I've already said as much as I kind of wanted to about Michael Ajao or Ajao, which is that, yeah, he's a nice guy and you like him, but just a bit bland for me. So
I thought he was a great character. Terrence Stamp didn't get near enough screen time.
I have one person I forgot to mention, by the way, which is the character you mentioned earlier, and I've got it written down somewhere. Her name is Jocasta, the character.
I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Yeah, I looked up how to pronounce this one. It's pronounced Synnøve Carlson, apparently. I think she was great, and she's one of those actresses where every time I watch the movie, I'm like, I know this girl from somewhere, whether it be an old soap opera that I'd seen her in or another film or something. Nope, just this movie. She just has one of those presences where you feel like you've seen her. And she's a great little actress, and I have to say, a great performance. Because, yes, you hate her, but you're supposed to. So the bitch characters are never easy to play, but she's great. And I do love the sheer, like, the indignation when she almost gets stabbed in the face as well. It's kind of beautifully painted.
By the way, I looked it up. It is a J.O.
Ajao, thank you. Right.
Yep.
So it's Synnøve Carlson and Michael Ajao. And now we know. that's all I wanted to say. So yeah, over to you guys. The floodgates are open. Any other actors you wanted to mention or you wanted to see? Anything you want to say about them?
No, I think, like, again, I think it's, if I do have problems with this movie, it's not with any of the performances. All the performances in this are good.
Cool.
Same. I did nothing else. I mean, we mentioned all the big ones that, you know, all the main characters, and there's great little small ones. Some of it, like, there's nothing that I would change with the acting. So
awesome. I have so much to say about the directing, so I'll jump straight in, because again, this is going to take some time. So, but before I do that, DK, do you have anything you wanted to say about the directing?
Yeah, I've got a bit.
I thought you might.
Best capture the 1960s ambience by using anamorphic lenses and using spherical lenses for the more modern era depicted in the film. That's why there's a bit of a switch there. The first song Eloise plays when she settles into a new room is Cilla Black's You're My World. This choice apparently serves two purposes. The sharp violin notes at the beginning have a stabbing sound reminiscent of 1960s Psycho, and Cilla Black's appearance at the Café de Paris leaves it unclear whether this was a vision of a night she really performed there or part of a dream inspired by playing that song before Eloise went to bed. The alleyway that Ellie runs down, it's called Newman Passage. It's also where the opening murder was filmed for Michael Powell's 1960 movie Peeping Tom, which I believe you watched recently.
I did. Yeah. I bought it recently on 4K. I'm going to have to put that on the list to review sometime. Such a good movie.
Yeah. The shot of Eloise running into the red lit restaurant in the heavy rain with wet hair, it's an homage to Suspiria.
It is, because that's a giallo film. Bringing it right back around.
During the chase in the art school, once the ghost men start appearing at the door with two windows, it's apparently a recreation of the poster from Shaun of the Dead.
That makes sense, because it's a phone booth in that poster, but I see what they're going with.
Yeah, the ending scene was partly reshot because test audiences responded overwhelmingly negatively to a scene showing Ellie hugging Jocasta backstage, the two seemingly having become friends in the end. Yeah, they didn't like that.
Why? That's a good moment. People are idiots.
At 1 hour 35 minutes, Edgar Wright says, "This is the point in the movie where I get excited. It's the scene where Eloise enters Mrs. Collins' flat and we see the envelope and figurine tip-offs. Christopher McQuarrie asks Wright, why do you give away the twist just before the twist? He says, and it's because Wright likes the idea that the sharp audience members will catch the clues and find themselves ramping up in anticipation. He adds that it's something he recalls most vividly from Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs when Clarice enters Buffalo Bill's kitchen.
I kind of want to go into my notes because I have a lot to get through, and apologies if I'm stepping on toes, or if you want to jump in and kind of second anything or add your own opinions, feel free. The first thing I want to mention, because I absolutely adore it, and I think it's what made me fall in love with this film, is the shot where Eloise first arrives back in the past, and it feels like it's either a tracking shot or it feels all like it's all one shot, even though it's not, and it employs so many cool tricks and visually looks so amazing, from like following through the door to the club to seeing Ellie reflected in the mirror shattered a lot of times, as we see Sandy climb up the stairs, or the switch between the two of them in the mirror where Ellie becomes Sandy and vice versa, and the way they used the Phelps twins from Harry Potter so that they could have, you know, there's no mirror there but they're both doing the same action because twins, so very cheap and economical way of doing that particular gag. I loved all that, and then that entire scene, like I said, just visually absolutely gorgeous. The way that they kind of, I don't know if it's a deliberate kind of Marx Brothers homage, but the whole moment where they're mirroring each other in the mirror always reminds me of when, that Marx Brothers skit. I'm sure you all know it if you know your films. Yeah. And following that, the dance sequence, which is just epic, where Matt Smith is dancing with, you know, Sandy, who was also Ellie and vice versa. And
well, I've learned got to that... on that in a little while, so
I know exactly what you're gonna say, but okay, I won't ruin that then. But yeah, but I think it looks amazing. I love all the staging. I think the set design and everything, the way it invokes the 60s is perfect. Obviously I wasn't there, but still, the neon lights and stuff, the way that it opens with a central kind of square of light, almost like the scene at the end of The Searchers. It ends in the same way, but it's actually opening the fashion show, whereas in the introduction, it's introducing you to Ellie. And throughout, it always shows characters in kind of spotlights and things centered in that exact same way, where it's all center of the frame and there's, you know, a harsh beam of light there. Lots of, sort of, as I said, for me, very giallo-inspired scenes of being disorienting. So that's when things lose focus or the camera jostles about all over the place, or you find yourself feeling, you know, a little bit queasy because you're out of your element. I should probably stop at this point and say Giallo is, because I haven't really specified it, it's kind of like, what's the best way to put this? It's a combination of psychological thriller and slasher that is really popular in Italy. The main guy that you'll know of who does Giallo films is the director Dario Argento, and some of the films that I would recommend to watch to see that work would be Suspiria, Tenebrae, Deep Red, or Profondo Rosso, I believe its title is in Italian, Eyes Without a Face, I think he did a version of Phantom of the Opera, so yeah, just some slight pompous, pretentious film information there, but I do love the way that it kind of it uses all of those tropes as well, because it kind of clues you into what kind of film you're watching, or it did with me. The scenes of the ghosts creeping in on Ellie in the library are some of the most wonderful horror in a non-particularly horror film, and let's see, where was I? And again, it's part of the movie that obviously it deals with, you know, identity and things like that. But the fact that it does so by reflections an awful lot. So there's so much use of mirrors and so much traveling through mirrors and mirroring the characters and the characters switching via a mirror. I just think it's brilliant. It's the way that does it. I've got nothing but good things to say. And where was I going to say? The other thing is, yeah, I love the soundtrack of this, which I'll talk about probably a little bit more in music. But I do love that the director has music playing or lyrics from music playing that mirror what's happening on screen at certain times, which is so kind of clever. So there's the shot of when Sandy learns the truth about Jack, that, you know, he's talking to the creep that he punched and it was obviously a setup. And the song that's playing has the line, "Just who's pulling the strings." And yeah, when Sandy's kind of back in the room for the first time as an older woman, it plays "There's Always Something There to Remind Me," which again was very on the nose. So, yeah, I think that's all I did really have. Oh, this is a very specific scene, but again, it's such a nice giallo kind of horror scene. The scene where the eyes are reflected in the knife. I would love to have that just as a poster. Yeah. I can't believe they didn't use that as poster art because it's just so good. Okay, that will shut up now because that's what I had. So over to you guys. Anything on the direction now that I've blurted out my thoughts?
Like, there was also some things that signaled it was Edgar Wright to the, because yes, it didn't use a lot of those hard, like the frenetic things that you were talking about, DK, but like it did use them some, like a lot of times there going was some, in and out of the dream world and stuff like that used a lot of the similar cuts and things that Edgar Wright loves to use.
The kind of the murders and stuff, I think, too, as well. And there's that great moment where, like I said, it's almost like Ellie is being pulled through the mirror. It's virtually like a Nightmare on Elm Street sequence where she gets pulled through, you know, the camera pans out from the 60s through the bedroom mirror in the present day. She gets pulled through the mirror. She's now in the 60s in that bedroom. And it's just kind of, it was all quick, but so kind of like, wow, flashy. I like it. And there's moments like that, like I said, the murder, the kind of the eyes reflected in the knife, the way that the murders themselves are very visceral and very fast. Yeah. VFX production design, DK, do you have something? I think you might.
I think you know the answer to that.
Yeah,
Wright decided early on that if you really wanted to capture the Soho ambience, he would have to film on location there as opposed to recreating it in a similar neighborhood or on a studio soundstage. An enormous amount of logistical planning was needed to work around the bustling area because so many of the local businesses were open 24/7. Wright described the London location shoot as a Herculean endeavor, requiring the close cooperation of his location manager with the City of Westminster. Period cars, clothing, and storefront signs had to be organized to accurately reflect the era. The entrance used for the legendary Café de Paris is actually the Empire Cinema in Haymarket, which is just a few hundred yards away from the real Café de Paris near Leicester Square. In December 2020, the club announced it was permanently closing down after almost 100 years due to the impact of the COVID-19 lockdowns. The costume party scene, it's filmed with extras from the London College of Fashion, and Edgar Wright just told them to go wild with their own costumes. I don't know if you noticed, but the little clique headed up by Jocasta, they're all dressed as characters from The Craft.
Yep.
Yep.
Fittingly, Jocasta is the one dressed as the villain of that movie.
Yeah. As you were going to alluding to earlier, Mike, the scene where Eloise first sees Sandy through the mirror is done practically. To achieve the mirror effect, the cloakroom attendant is played by twins James and Oliver Phelps. Most of the scenes with Eloise following Sandy through the mirror was shot with Thomas and Mackenzie on set. Mackenzie's area was covered with a green screen where the VFX team recreated the reflection. And although during the dance sequence between Sandy, Ellie and Jack, there were only two moments that were not practical, there's a quick cut transition early on, but the rest is accomplished live with choreography, allowing Mackenzie and Anya Taylor-Joy to swap in and out of the frame. Apparently the Blu-ray features the sequence uncut in a wide shot to make it all visible.
It does, and it made me appreciate that all the more because it's just amazing to watch. Honestly, choreography.
The taxi sequence where Eloise arrives in Seoul and is enjoying the views more than the driver's conversation, it was filmed using three separate taxis. Thomas and Mackenzie was filmed in one, the driver was filmed in the other, and a third was used for operations. They did it this way to ensure the scenes out the window matched up between shots. The cars drove together with the actors hearing each other over speakers. Most people, lazy people, said Edgar Wright would do it by green screen.
filmmaking can be difficult times.
Yeah. To achieve the shots of the students walking down the nighttime Soho streets, the crew hid a Steadicam within a bicycle rickshaw taxi, which are commonly used around Soho. The road was not closed off, and the extras in the shot were just unaware that they were in a movie.
I mean, I don't have a lot to say, except obviously I love, like I've already mentioned, the costume design and the recreation of the 60s locations. I think it's, again, I wasn't there, but for me, it looks pretty flawless. I can't fault it. I love the style, the fashion, the way it kind of is all portrayed. And I really, really love that Ellie kind of gradually matches her style to Sandy's more and more as the film goes on. Not just because she looks hot, but because I like that kind of, you know, that way of playing visually with identity and losing yourself, I think
reminded me a lot of Single White Female.
Oh, it's interesting you say that. It reminded me a fair bit of Black Swan, weirdly enough.
Oh, right. I've not seen Black Swan. So.
Okay. But yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, what was I going to say? Oh, and I have a little, this is, you know, a nerdy nitpick kind of type situation that will potentially ruin the film for you now that you know it, but it won't. It's not really that bad, but it's a bit of a Cinema Sins ding type situation. I just really like the idea when I heard it of, you know, it being cleverer than me. When Ellie goes to the library and she's trying to research Sandy's murder, she looks at the entirety of the 60s and gets John to help her doing the same thing. And he mentions it's an overwhelming task. It's pretty noticeable when she first flashes back that there's a massive poster for Thunderball right in front of her. Could she not have just looked up when that film was released in the UK and narrowed it down quite easily? That's all I'm saying about that.
No, yeah. That's clever.
So very quickly, then we're going to move to the music or the sound, you know, generally. DK, you're Mr. Music, so I'm going to quickly throw to you for anything you have about that.
Composer Steve Price composed some of the score before a single frame of film had been shot. Edgar Wright was excited to find a central theme amid the demo music, which he applied from the very start of the movie. The shot looking through neon and down onto the girls walking down the street features a snippet of John Barry's score for Beat Girl, a.k.a. Wild for Kicks from 1960. And apparently they also used Ennio Morricone's music for The Bird with the Crystal Plumage from 1970 as a temp score early on in the editing. They also used the School in Flames track from Pino Donaggio's Carrie score on set as motivation for Mackenzie during the nightmarish scene. Yeah,
I made a note of that, actually. I thought when the hands start busting through the floorboard, I was like, this is Evil Dead / Carrie.
You picked up on it subconsciously. I think the use of music, I'm not a big 60s music person, but I think the use of music, as you mentioned earlier, Mike, relating to events on screen, I think it was really well done. There is some really good use of music in this, even if it's not to my taste. Although I will say,
it is to mine.
it's all 60s music, apart from the one 80s track in the party, which is Happy House, Susie and the Banshees.
Oh, I didn't know that. So yeah, I loved Anya's version of Downtown, performed a cappella, which is super impressive. She's obviously quite a talented singer. And the use, again, on the nose, but playing the song Eloise, which is mentioned obviously in dialogue during the confrontation scene with Terrence Stamp. And obviously, as you said, the title song playing in the credits is pretty good. So anything about the...
I do love where he's like conducting along to it as he's sat there and you just see him from the back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's great. It's so well filmed. So what about you then, Michael? Anything on the music and sound before I shift us along quickly?
I mean, sound design was fantastic, and it's Edgar Wright, so every bit of the music was intentional and purposeful for what it needed to do for part of the story and for entertaining. So I thought it was awesome. Great.
Cool. Well, what I'm going to do then is we're trying to get done as quickly as we can here. So I'm going to move us into the audience response. I always put out a thing on social media for these regular Silver Screen podcasts to ask what you, the audience, thought about it. Didn't get a lot of responses, but via a couple of Facebook things and Letterboxd, I do have some. So first of all, from the Facebook page Cult Cinema and TV, Lee Simpson just says, loved it, 4 stars. Gordon Hesketh says, remember enjoying this a lot, and it has Diana Rigg, which is always a bonus. On Blue Sky, Ron B., PJ the Cat, says, apparently I gave it a 2.5-star rating on Letterboxd. I don't remember much about it, and I like Edgar Wright quite a bit. Shrug emoji. Okay. Speaking of... One more from the Silver Screen group. George White. Hey, George. From Pasty Sheep says, love it. I've definitely reviewed it at some point with Will Templar, our other friend. Got so much love for Edgar Wright films. This was a joy at the cinema. That's 4 stars. From Cult Cinema and TV again, Al Winter says, some nice set pieces leading to a weak ending. I gave this a rewatch recently and it annoyed me because it gets a lot right. Great attention to detail for the period, good performances and some bravura camera work and editing. Some nice giallo primary coloured lighting too. Then it spaffs it all with a piss weak ending and pointless comedy coda. Frustrating missed opportunity, I think. 3 out of 5. Okay. Lee Simpson just says, loved it. 4 stars. Over on Letterboxd, my nephew Harry says, simply another bagger. My niece Jess says, I'll watch and rate anything 5 stars if it has Anya Taylor-Joy, and gives it 5 stars. 115 Bryce says, I wish Anya Taylor-Joy haunted my daydreams. 4 stars, you and me both. Ellis Denzel says, the ending was not what I was expecting. I just wanted something different. 3.5 stars, not specifying what he wanted different, but okay. Alex Marzonia says, I watched this a second time and I liked it so much better. I knew Wright's movies always reward multiple viewings, and it certainly did here without the burden of expectations weighing it down. Yes, there are many faults I find, but I understand the homage and tone they're going for, so it's easier to forgive. Edgar Wright is my guy, so I'm biased in forgiving the problems when the movie as a whole is just so dang good and fun, and he gives it 5 stars. And the aforementioned Will Templar says, I didn't think I was going to like it after the first 15 or so minutes. Then it ascends. Boy, does it ascend. Anya Taylor-Joy, the late Diana Rigg, and Matt Smith were brilliant. Thomasin McKenzie had her moments, but the other three were simply terrific. And he gives it 4 stars. And yeah, that's all the audience opinions, which are relatively, I think, positive for the most part. So with that done, we're going to jump quickly into giving our favorite character moment and line, then our conclusion and score, then we can get out of here. I know DK doesn't do this on the cult classics, but I always do on my versions. So we're going to go around the houses here and ask, first of all, who was your favorite character and why? And I'll start with you, Michael Whaley.
My favorite character is probably Eloise.
Cool.
It's an easy one, but I mean, I liked that character the most.
That's fair enough. Okay. DK?
It's a close one between Ellie and Jack, but I'm going to have to go with Ellie because she's the protagonist, even though,
Jack.
Despite what you said. Jack or John. Okay. Despite what you were saying about...
Yeah, that's different.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. I will now go and...
I really relate with police. Matt Smith's character in
this. Yeah. No, despite what you were saying earlier, I don't think John's... that much of a wet fish. I think he's one of the only genuinely likable people in this movie, and his intentions are not strictly honourable. They're as damn close as you're going to get. But I'll still go with Ellie.
Okay, I also went with Ellie. I just said it's a brilliant leading central performance, relatable, sympathetic, and easy to empathise with. So, what was your favourite moment or scene in the film, Whaley?
I think it's that, like, just for visuals wise, it's that first trip into the dream world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that entire thing, that first entire dream, I mean, it's multiple scenes technically.
Yeah, but, I know.
Like, but... that entire first dream sequence, I think, was just beautiful. And
yeah, made me happy. I picked exactly the same thing, so I'm with you. I know it's technically, it's not technically one shot or whatever, one take, even though it seems like it, but it's just so bloody good. Everything from when she wakes up and sees the Thunderball poster right through to, like I said, the start of the dance sequence, such a good scene. I could have chosen a lot of them, but that one just, like I already mentioned, that really stuck with me. Sorry, DK, jump in early. What was yours?
I've literally got written down the first night Yeah, there's a genuine ambiguity there. Is it a dream? Is it something more? There's like an ethereal feeling with the mirrors, the atmosphere, the music. It's just stunning.
You could study just that scene, and I recommend potentially doing it if you ever are interested in kind of filmmaking. There's tons of YouTube videos that just break down that scene. Again, I wouldn't do that. We'd be here forever, but there we go. So lastly, what is your favorite line in the film, Mike?
Ooh, I always forget about that question.
It doesn't matter if you haven't got one. I mean, I struggled if I'm honest.
Come back to me in a second. Let me think on it for a second.
Did you have anything you could think of, DK?
Yeah, I've got... this is London. Someone has died in every room, in every building, and on every street corner in the city.
Ooh. Mine's by the same character, but a very different tone. I already mentioned that kind of like the kind of cheesy but quite clever references. So it's when Diana Rigg's character goes, "Will you keep it down? It's enough to wake the bloody dead." Just as the ghosts are literally waking and kind of appearing to her. Like, I get it. I see what you did. So, yeah. Anything coming to you, Whaley?
I really liked, I mean, it's not necessarily that does anything for the story, but it was the interaction with John, John. Yeah, John. I thought I was doing the same DK thing with Jack for a second.
No.
That's John, when he gives back the Coke that he had accidentally stolen.
Oh, yeah.
That was just a cute little exchange there, and I really liked that.
Yeah, the apology Coke is really good.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, right, we're going to jump into our conclusions and our scores out of 5 stars, as we always do. Whaley, why don't we start with you? And do you have your conclusion and your score, or would you rather one of us starts?
No, I can go ahead. It's Edgar Wright. I have a hard time finding faults with everything. I mean, we can nitpick small things here and there with the writing and different things like that, but I think overall, it's not my favorite Edgar Wright movie, but it's in top 5. And
he's only made 6.
Nah, he's more than 6, didn't he?
No, 6. Well, 7 if you count the documentary about the Sparks Brothers. But...
Okay. So, yeah, it is. It's not my least favorite. But, I mean, you've got to have ones here and there. But the Cornetto Trilogy and Scott Pilgrim are my top 4. So,
okay. All right.
It's right after those. But I think it's great. But I'm going to give it a 4.5.
Okay. 4.5 from Michael Whaley. TK, do you want to go next?
Yeah, I've said it's good, but it's not truly great. It looks gorgeous. The performances by Mackenzie and Taylor-Joy hold this thing together. Even Matt Smith plays quite a meaty role in this that, you know, for once doesn't end up on the cutting room floor. However, looks aside, after that first watch, I get a kind of Law of Diminishing Returns vibe with this one. It doesn't hold up to repeated viewings, in my opinion. And once you go back, though it still has a polish, it all feels a little flimsy, perhaps relying too much on coincidence and with characters introduced and dismissed just to serve a plot purpose. The entire thing also undermines, in my opinion anyway, what came before in its third act. I was never enthralled by the swinging 60s era, so while some of the music I recognise, none of them really strike a chord with me, which I duly admit is very much a me problem, but I will say that the use of music throughout is very well done. Wright's direction is competent, but while it looks beautiful / seedy when needed, and it features no small amount of atmosphere, it belies a little of the emptiness beneath. Scratch the surface, and underneath it's not what it seems, which is kind of ironic for a film on this subject matter. I will give it a rewatch sometime, but as I said, it's good, but not great, and I really wanted it to be great, so I'm going to give it 3.5.
Thank you, DK, for your last ever appearance on the podcast. Okay. My conclusion is, again, long-winded. It always is, but I'm going to go through it anyway. An incredibly powerful work, almost an exquisite piece of filmmaking, and the kind of movie that reaffirms my love for what cinema can achieve. The technical wizardry is breathtaking, from the use of camera techniques, reflections, and lights, to music that's both diegetic, appropriate, and frequently slyly comments on what's happening. The inspiration of genres like giallo and psychological thriller is clear, and very well replicated without feeling like a rip-off of anything to me. The performances are utterly captivating, with my highlight being Mackenzie in a lead role that gives her a lot to do, and she pulls it off with real emotional depth, though Taylor-Joy and Rigg are also great at generating emotional reactions, and there's nobody who lets the side down in the whole cast. The story is one I thought was very engaging, with a final twist or two that I found effective and really liked. While not flawless, it's also affecting that I still worry my score might be too stingy, though like many, there are parts of the very end that I find to be a little underwhelming and disappointing compared to what's come before. The ending felt slightly rushed and muddled with some story beats I didn't love and a final shot that left me more confused than satisfied. This is hardly a feel-good film, and it's not one you'd casually re-watch unless you're in the right frame of mind. Some might argue that part of the film prioritised style over substance, but I think that's way too harsh. Ultimately, my score reflects the sheer impact it had on me and the admiration I have for so much of the artistry on display. Excellent stuff, and I also gave it 4.5, or 4.5 out of 5. So, adding those together, dividing by the three of us here, gives us a final score for Last Night in Soho of 4.1 out of 5. So, you know, not too bad. Just after the 4-star, which I think we can live with. I'm still never going to speak to DK again. But
no. Oh, shut up. You will, you bitch. You'll love it.
Ah, no, it's fine. It could have been worse. So, yeah. And thus, like Ellie, we awaken back from the swinging 60s and face the reality of our stupid modern world. But at least we've got movies to keep us sane, mostly. I'd like to thank our guest, Michael Whaley, for rejoining us on this one.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
It always is, and you always have nice insight and lots to say about the movies, which is always good. So where can people find you on the internet, and do you have anything you wanted to plug specifically?
Right now, always Michael Whaley on Instagram, on TikTok. I don't post a ton on there, but right now, nothing really. You can turnaphrasefilms.com and see stuff on that. Always working on things, but have nothing to plug that, but maybe in the next month or two I will. So we'll okay. Get back with you then. I'm sure I'll be on something else by then as well. So
awesome, no problem. And as always, thanks to my groovy co-host DK.
Not at all, always a pleasure.
I wrote that before hearing your views on the movie, so. Is there anything you want to plug upcoming on kind of cult classics or anything along those lines?
Nah, just more cheese. Tune in if you like garbage films.
They're not all garbage, I should say, but yeah. Of course, you can always find us on multiple social media locations via the link tree in every episode's description or the handy graphic that you'll be seeing if you're watching on YouTube, which you probably should. We'll be back in just 1 week from today with our next Silver Screen review, where myself and a bevy of guests are heading to Japan to trade in our weak fleshy bodies for some sweet tech as we break down a genuinely iconic 1990s anime, Scarlett Johansson not included. Until then, thank you for joining us for this one. And do remember,
when you're alone and life is getting you lonely, you can always go, ach, goon toon, next!
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Mike Wilson and DK. Behind the Scenes section by DK. Additional material by Mike Wilson. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. Link to all of these places can be found via the link tree listed in this episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production, created, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson. We'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, and share us around like a beloved old video cassette. We hope to see you next time for more movie magic. Until then, remember, life moves pretty fast, so stop and watch a movie now and then.